Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. I want to tell you all a story that was almost lost to history. It begins 70 years ago, on the morning of July 5th, 1954, when Lincoln Elementary goes up in flames. Lincoln was the segregated school for black children in Hillsboro, Ohio. And even though Brown versus Board of Education had just struck down the separate but equal doctrine, the district didn't have immediate plans to integrate. The school board decides to patch up Lincoln rather than let the children attend one of the two white elementary schools in town. And what happens next is an incredible story. Here to help me tell it is Rebecca Asmo, Executive Director of Ohio Humanities, and Melvin Barnes Jr., Program Officer at Ohio Humanities. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hillsboro, Ohio is about an hour southwest of Columbus. It's a pretty small town. About 6,000 people live there. Melvin, what was it like in the 1950s?
Yeah, in the 1950s, Hillsboro was a pretty typical town. In many ways, it reflected a lot of the country, which was that, you know, African-American people tended to live on one part of town and white folks tended to live on another part of town. And the town was segregated, like a lot of the United States at that time.
Ohio Humanities, your organization, interviewed several black women who lived there in the 1950s for your documentary about the Lincoln School and the story we're going to tell this hour. I want to play a clip of them describing their life in Hillsboro in 1954.
There's a lot of places we weren't allowed to go, like a lot of the restaurants.
You didn't eat in the restaurants. You got your food and you got it in a bag and you left.
I do remember the movie theater had a black section, but it was just routine that the black people sat in a certain section.
So that's the backdrop when the landmark Supreme Court decision Brown versus Board of Education comes down in the spring of 1954. And Melvin, just because school segregation was now illegal on paper, didn't mean it was illegal in practice.
Yeah, exactly. So that decision came out, but it didn't necessarily come down with a whole lot of guidance. They said that, you know, segregation was not constitutional, but they didn't tell us what needed to happen from then on. And that's where you get into Brown 2. And a year later, they go into this, you know, trying to figure out how schools should desegregate. But in making that decision the way that they did in 1954, that meant that every corner of the country, every small town, every city had to figure out what it meant to desegregate on the ground. And that's kind of how we get to this story of Hillsboro, because it took concerned citizens to actually make sure that that court ruling meant something in practice.
Rebecca, what did the Hillsboro School Board decide after the ruling came down?
Well, and I just want to quickly add something to what Melvin said. So in doing the research for this documentary, Melvin was actually reading some of the opinions from Brown and Brown 2. And Chief Justice Warren, one thing that was important to him in the Brown decision was that it be a unanimous decision and that all of the justices, sign on to that decision. And because of that, they really had to hedge a little bit. And so they added this line in the decision that said that communities should desegregate their schools with all deliberate speed. And that is deliberately vague. And so that meant that communities could say, hey, we don't really have the school facilities to integrate right now, and so we're just going to wait. And so in a community like Hillsboro, like most communities throughout America, they did nothing after Brown. And so that is actually where we have a character come into this story named Philip Partridge that I know we'll talk about later.
I'll also add that immediately following that Brown decision, the newspapers in town report the school superintendent. He explains that the Supreme Court decision will have no immediate impact on the schools in Hillsboro.
Integration was essentially put on hold. And it sounds like the Hillsboro School Board said that they were going to do integration after they finished remodeling one of the white elementary schools. So it was going to be a couple years down the line. And one of the things in the documentary that I think is so important before we get into what happened is that the Lincoln School, the black school, was not great. It was not a quality school. I want to play another cut from your documentary. Here are two former Lincoln School students describing the place.
When we were at the Lincoln School, there was three grades into one class. That was first, second, and third. And then the other room was fourth, fifth, and sixth. I remember the bathrooms being in the basement. And our books, half the pages were missing.
The white schools, they had books that we didn't have. They had like geography, they had maps, they had history books, and science. Those books we didn't have.
Melvin, so even before what we're about to talk about happens, and it's such a crazy twist in this story, the Lincoln School wasn't great.
No, the Lincoln School was a very old school building. It was, I believe, the approval for the building was set up in 1869.
It was
a very old school building. And actually, that piece of sound that you heard, which I believe was from Teresa, that was after they had put the bathrooms in the basement. For many years, students had to go outside to the outhouses to use the restrooms at Lincoln School.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and the heating was very poor. So a lot of the time, students would even attend classes or, you know, have their classes in the basement because it was closer to, I don't know how to describe it, the boiler, the steam room, whatever it was that they would use to try to heat the building. But there was also issues with that because sometimes it got too hot down there. So they would have to come kind of streaming up from the basement with all these kids in tow. So the building was not in great shape, not at all.
Rebecca, that brings us to Philip Partridge. He's a white man who lives in town, and he decides to take this matter of school integration into his own hands. What does he do?
Yeah, so Philip Partridge was actually the county engineer in Highland County, and he was a proponent of desegregation, and he wanted Hillsborough to desegregate their schools and live up to the Brown decision. He went to the school board and asked them to do that. They said no. And so he went, I believe it was the evening of July 4th, and with a can of gasoline and set fire to the Lincoln School.
And the first time I heard that, I think my jaw like hung open.
Yeah.
I was like, he did what now?
Because it's a radical act.
It's a choice.
Yeah. And his intention with that was that if he destroyed the Lincoln School, it would force the school board to desegregate schools and send black students to the two white elementary schools. But instead of that, the school board met and they said, well, we're actually just going to make some repairs. They allocated $4,000 to make repairs to the Lincoln School. And they said, we're going to send the students back to that school. And that's when parents in that community, and really led by mothers, said, that's enough. And they had concerns about their children's safety. It was a two-story building. They didn't want their children going in, you know, they didn't believe that it would be safe. They had fears that the building would collapse.
Also, $4,000. I know this is 1954, so money went differently, but $4,000 doesn't seem like enough for a structure fire fix.
Exactly. So it really says a lot about, you know, how they valued that building and how they valued, you know, education for black children in that community. And so that was really the impetus for, you know, what became this sustained political action for women in Hillsborough.
Yeah, Melvin, it starts with women like Imogene Curtis and Gertrude Clemens just talking across their fences in their neighborhood. And then it leads to this petition that they file, right? It demands immediate integration.
Yeah, so the members of the black community submit this petition at the school board meeting and say, hey, we would like to have our students attend Washington and Webster immediately. We have no intentions of sending our students back to the Lincoln School. That petitioned by the school board is essentially, eventually denied. But what ends up happening is when school begins in 1954, about 50 black students attend Washington and Webster. They made their sort of intentions known. They said our students are going to report to these schools. And they were able to actually remain in those schools for the week. And I believe there was a week-long break that following week. But what ends up happening is in that break time, in that meantime, the school board draws up basically a scheme to remove those black students from Washington and Webster and send them back to the Lincoln School through rezoning. And the women, as a result, are told your children must return back to Lincoln or you guys will be deemed truant and the parents will be held responsible.
Well, and when Melvin talks about rezoning, they drew up incredibly gerrymandered districts.
I was going to say, you can see them in the documentary and you're like, yeah. Okie dokie.
Well, and the districts for Lincoln School actually weren't even
contiguous,
right? They were two completely separate districts. And so, it's a very interesting example of how gerrymandering is used to accomplish a lot of different things.
And one thing that's really tricky about the way that they drew up the school zones is there actually was an elementary school aged white student who lived next door to Lincoln School, but he was not assigned to Lincoln School. He attended one of the other schools in town.
That is some detailed map making to like be like, okay, we know there's a kid who lives here. We're going to whoop right around that house and go around. Yeah, I mean, that is the definition of gerrymandering, right? You carve the districts you want, not the ones that are contiguous or that keep community together.
Right, right.
And so they carve these new districts. They say, hey, you got to go back to this school. It's fine. We've fixed it with our $4,000, which is dubious at best. And the women, the mothers in these communities say no. And so they march to Washington and Webster and they say, let our kids in, essentially.
Yeah, and I think, and Melvin can give some more detail to this, they began a march, but that also came along with a lawsuit that they filed. And they went to the NAACP, and there was an office in Dayton, and they also had support from the headquarters, which was in New York. And so Constance Baker Motley, who was really, kind of the key lawyer for desegregation for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, came to Hillsboro. There were attorneys from the Dayton NAACP. They filed a lawsuit that began locally. But as that lawsuit kind of worked its way through the system, they began a daily march, which is what the film tells this story of. And this march, it began in 1954. So it actually began a year before the Montgomery bus boycott. And it ultimately lasted for 2 years. And it was one of the longest sustained actions of the entire civil rights movement. And it was led entirely by women and children.
We're going to take a quick break. Coming up, we're going to talk about the mothers and their children who begin a march for integration that will last for 2 years. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. One of the longest sustained civil rights marches in our country took place right here in Hillsboro, Ohio. Black mothers and their children marched to the white elementary school in town every day for 2 years, asking the district to let their children in. And every day, they were told no. We're sharing their story this hour, Still with us is Rebecca Asmo, Executive Director at Ohio Humanities, and Melvin Barnes, Jr., Program Officer at Ohio Humanities. When we left off, it was Friday, September 17th, 1954, and the mothers in Hillsboro got up, dressed their children, and walked to Webster Elementary. When the school bell rang, they sent their kids in the doors, and shortly after, the kids were sent back out by officials and told they were no longer on the school's roster and they could not go in. And this is the first day in a two-year-long civil rights movement. That is incredible, Melvin.
Yeah, and we had mentioned before that they had filed this court case. And I think one thing that's really genius about what the mothers did was they were not going to let the school board say, we are not holding your children out of school. So they made sure that they marched every morning, which I have a two-year-old and I can barely get one out the door. So I don't know how they got 30 plus kids out the door, no matter what, and got them to the school every day. And that basically made sure that they held the school board's feet to the fire because they would not be able to deny that they were holding those kids out.
I spoke with Teresa Williams, who marched with her mother and her siblings. Teresa was 10 years old when the march started, a fact that she remembers vividly because she'd broken her hip earlier that year.
And I was in the hospital for 3 months in traction. And then when we got out, they told me I'd have to learn how to walk again. And I reminded Aaron over at the Wilmington thing that we had. I did my first physical therapy at 10 years old when we started that walking to the school.
Oh my goodness, the walking was part of your rehab?
It wasn't. They didn't tell us that, but when I had a limp, and so when we had to walk, I had a problem with the limp. And I told him over there this summer, whenever it was in Wilmington this year, I said that was my first physical therapy when I was 10 years old.
Can you tell
me? Paid off.
Can you tell me about your mother, Sally Williams? What was she like?
She was very quiet, and I'm the second oldest of 11 children. And she was a home mother. And when we started that school thing, there was four of us children in the march. And the rest of them was at home, my grandma.
What I love about Teresa's story, Rebecca, is how it highlights what a community effort this was. Her mother had 11 children, which, first of all, is hard for me to wrap my head around, having 11 kids. But she couldn't march with all 11, so her mother takes the four youngest and makes it possible.
Yeah, I mean, this was a community effort in so many ways. So you think about who would have stayed home with younger children, because most of the mothers did have large families, did have fathers, were working outside the home. There were also some of the mothers who had jobs and, you know, but some of their children were participating in the march or not going to the schools. You also think for 2 years, children did not have a school to go to because they, you know, Lincoln School was not a safe school for them to go to. And they were prevented from going to the white schools. So the mothers actually organized homeschools, and they called them kitchen schools. And at the beginning of each week, Quaker teachers would come and provide the mothers with lesson plans. And then there were designated women in the communities who would teach school in their communities, or, you know, in their kitchens. And that's how the children kept up their academics. When I first joined Ohio Humanities, it was right in the middle of the pandemic. And I became really emotional learning about this story because, first, I don't really think I've ever done anything every single day for 2 years. And when I think about these women getting up, getting dressed, getting all their children dressed, and when you see photos of it, they're dressed beautifully. Everything, you know, they just look perfect. To do this march, to be harassed by the community, to then many of them go to work, go to work in domestic jobs, which are very difficult. Some of them then go and teach children all day. They're participating in these court cases. And in court cases where they're treated very disrespectfully, they're not allowed to speak in the courtroom. You know, it's just incredible challenges that they're facing. And, you know, I think about, you know, I always complain that getting my kids to school every day is the worst part of my day and I can barely do it and I'm in my pajamas. And so when I just think about, you know, how resilient they were every single day to get up and do that, you know, it's just an incredible story. It's something that we can all learn from. It's something that we should be grateful for. And we should just be really proud of them and proud of this story as Ohioans.
One of the other things that Teresa told me and really emphasizes that community is that her own mother didn't have much in the way of formal education.
Well, she only had, I think it was a 10th grade education. And I didn't realize that until after, my younger sister told me my mom went and got her GED not too many years before she passed. And I said, well, I didn't know that. And she said, yeah, but mom always told us kids, she said, you're going to graduate. You're going to stay in school and graduate till you get out of there. And all 10 of us graduated except for my one brother.
So you think she saw education as a pathway to a better life for you guys?
Yes. And she always read to us.
Melvin, how common is Teresa's story in this narrative that they were coming from parents who lacked these formal educations and decided to take on homeschooling?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, fortunately, not everyone has found themselves in a situation where they have to homeschool their children. But I think that when you think about the arc of African-American history, it is very common that you have people of that generation who were not afforded the same educational opportunities, really prizing and understanding the importance of what it meant to go out and get an education. So I think that this really reflects the understanding. And I think that's also part of the reason why that Brown decision meant so much to a lot of Black folks at that time, because they understood that this meant that, okay, hopefully now our children can get a fair shake and they can go further than we were able to go. And that allows them to, you know, find jobs and live better lives than many of us had to live in the past.
Yeah, one of the things that Teresa said to me that really struck me was, you know, her mother was an avid reader. So she's like, she always thought her mother was smart and intelligent and well-read. And then she maybe could have done college or postgraduate had she been given the opportunity to do so. And she didn't. But I love that she went back and got her GED as an old woman to accomplish that in her life. But one of the most striking things that Teresa told me was that her daughter, so Sally's granddaughter, has a PhD.
And, oh, wow. And, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. She described her daughter as bookish and nerdy, but in a loving way. And that, yeah, she went on to postgraduate and to get a PhD.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I think is really powerful about this story is that it really has a long tail. I think the way that we teach, you know, Brown and the story of desegregation in the United States, we usually look at 1954 oftentimes as an endpoint. And really, it was just the beginning. And I think that that's one thing that this story really emphasizes. We all have, you know, a story to tell that's connected to this story. So I think that, yeah, that's a really poignant point.
Rebecca, why do you think they persisted day in and day out for 2 years? What do you think kept them going?
I mean, I think that's the story of the entire civil rights movement. This one is, you know, really remarkable. And I think it has a lot to do with the leadership of this march. Imogene, you know, who was really the organizer of this, was pretty incredible, and her daughter describes her as fearless, and she was for a very long time involved in the civil rights movement, and just really a dogged you know, I think personality and committed. So I think the leadership of this group of women had a lot to do with that. But I do think that this is really the story of the civil rights movement. And, you know, it's a long story. It's one that, you know, begins long before Brown, is continuing today, goes through generations of people. And so, you know, while what the Lincoln School marchers did is incredible, will always be incredible, I think it's part of a tapestry of resilience and resistance and perseverance, you know, that we see as just a really important part of, you know, the Black American story.
And adding on to that, I think that, you know, when I was studying in school, one of my favorite teachers would say, you know, movements are really hard to maintain. They're very hard to maintain. But I think, you know, one of the big pictures that you can take away from this is that idea of, you know, what people do for their children. And these mothers understood that if they didn't take this action and do this for their kids, there wasn't anyone else who was going to do it. So they had to wake up every day and make sure that they kept doing what they were doing.
I asked Teresa Williams this question, what kept them going? Why did she think they sustained it? And here's what she had to say.
I think some of that was because we were all together. We enjoyed being with each other. Because right, you went to walk that out there, there's a mile, I think, and then you come back, then you go right into your home school, and you were still together with a few of each, you know, each group. And then after that, you went home and did your chores. Then you might have a little bit of time to play before dark.
It sounds like maybe that's the reason it was successful, because you guys all stuck together for the entire time.
I believe that. And we're ones, you know, still living. We're still friends. I turned 81 on the 6th of June, but everybody said, how y'all get along so well? Hey, we had to.
I love that you guys are all still friends.
Mm-hmm.
I find that fascinating that they are, like, they were kids marching together and they're still really good friends.
Really good friends. And it's a wonderful thing to see. And I think Teresa does make a great point. The togetherness is all of it. And those relationships were key to it.
Even today, when you see them today, they're infectious. You can't help but, you know, strike up a conversation with them. And they are just so close, and they always are just very kind. So I think that, yeah, she hit the nail on the head. That community and having each other is really what allows you to persevere.
Yeah, she said they would talk and chat with their friends and sing songs. And, you know, you get to start your day with your buddies singing and chatting. And it's not a bad way to start your day if you think about it.
Yeah. Well, and it was, I think she says it was a mile there and a mile back. It was actually 2.5 miles round trip. And so while I'm sure the camaraderie could be at times pleasant, I think it's also important to remind people that they were doing a lot of that in Ohio winters. In they did it in snow, they did it in rain, they did it in windy weather, and it was probably really unpleasant a lot of days. And they continued to do it, but, you know, I think there were a lot of days where people didn't want to get out of bed, and they were probably encouraging one another too.
Yeah. I wonder, how does this civil rights action fit in with the national narrative that's unfolding in the mid-1950s?
Yeah, so, you know, this is one thing that's really interesting, right, is, you know, right when Brown comes down, you have this flurry of cases that are popping up all over the country that are like, hey, you know, we, you know, need these schools to be desegregated, and not today, because, you know, a lot of the school districts, what they did was embark on a sort of campaign of resistance, sometimes subtly, sometimes more forcefully. But what you're seeing in Hillsborough is really the leading edge of a lot of that not only resistance, but also that activism that sprung up in the wake of Brown. So you think this is a few years before the events in Little Rock. These are events that will become very sort of commonplace in the years following 1954. It just so happened that Hillsborough, Ohio, in the wake of Brown, was at the sort of front edge of that. And there's a number of cases that kind of hang around there, but Hillsborough was very early.
Yeah, a Time magazine article from 1956 says the situation in Hillsborough was the only integration battle happening in Ohio at that time.
And that, you know, that may or may not have been the case.
I wasn't sure.
I think that it was certainly the most high profile. And I think one thing that, reason why it was very difficult for towns in Ohio is for a long time, those of us in the North often told ourselves that issues of segregation were not a Northern issue. Many of them said that, you know, that's a Southern thing. That happens in Mississippi. It doesn't happen in Hillsborough, Ohio. What these mothers did was they shined a light or, you know, reflected that mirror back on the town and had them face that inconvenient truth of, no, desegregation exists in Hillsborough, Ohio. And I think that in the way that we remember this story, you know, I tell people in Hillsborough, I said, you can think about it this way. You guys were on the front edge of some national movements, you know, and that can be a good thing or a bad thing. It depends on how you want to look at it.
Yeah. And there were some major desegregation cases that happened in Dayton, here in Columbus, in Cleveland. They happened much later in the 70s, and sometimes mm-hmm. the decisions actually didn't even come down from the Supreme Court until like 79 or even 1980. A lot of that was because, though, the segregation was a little more under the radar. The tactics that the school board was using weren't as open as just like, we have a black school and then we have white schools that black students aren't allowed to attend. And so Hillsborough, their segregation looked a little bit more like the Jim Crow South. Mm-hmm. And that probably had a lot to do with the fact that there were a lot of people from the South and who had migrated north, both white people and black people. And, you know, again, like Melvin said, in the North, we often tried to tell ourselves, oh, we don't have Jim Crow segregation, but it was segregation and, you know, in a more subtle but equally as dangerous way.
The story certainly challenges some of our fundamental assumptions about North and South. You know, that part of the state was a portion of what was known as the Virginia Military District. So a lot of its cultural foundations at times were as much Virginian as it was anything else. And, you know, like Rebecca said, the other cities had different sort of dynamics. And, you know, one thing that I think cities like, you know, Cleveland and even Columbus, a lot of times we would say was that, you know, this isn't, you know, purposeful segregation. These are just settlement patterns, you know, as people moved into the town. But it took years for those court cases to, you know, work their way through communities in Cleveland and Columbus where they could sort of give the or shine a light on that lie and say, like, no, these schools were deliberately sort of planned out this way to make this school a predominantly black school or this school the white school. And then we get into another issue of, okay, well, once those cases start working through, you start to have what is termed white flight, people leaving those areas as people of color move into those schools. So it begins another sort of element of the story.
And in this particular story in Hillsborough with the Lincoln School, the march ends in 1956. So Rebecca, what brings the march to a close?
So the march ends. You know, ultimately, the Lincoln School case makes it all the way to the Supreme Court, and it becomes the first Northern test case of Brown versus Board of Education. Along with it was kind of argued with a few other cases that were bundled together, but it was argued by Thurgood Marshall in front of the Supreme Court, and they won their case, and the Supreme Court ordered the school district in Hillsborough to immediately desegregate their schools and integrate the white schools, which meant that the students were allowed to go to Washington and Webster elementaries. And that, you know, was the result that the families were hoping for.
Coming up, What happened when the district finally integrated its elementary schools? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're sharing the story of the Lincoln School Marchers this hour, a group of black mothers and their children from Hillsborough, Ohio, who spent 2 years marching for the integration of their public schools. Still with us is Rebecca Asmo, Executive Director at Ohio Humanities, and Ohio Humanities Program Officer Melvin Barnes, Jr. So we've reached the point in the story where the school starts to integrate. They lose their Supreme Court case, and the district has to send them to either Webster or Washington. And I talked with Teresa Williams about what it was like when the black students first started at Webster, and let's hear from her now.
Some of the kids that knew about it, they were mean. If they knew about it from the home, they were mean at school. But the ones that didn't know, they would get along with you. Some of them to this day are still my friends. I had a girl came to visit me the other day. She didn't graduate with me. She graduated a year before me. But she had a twin brother. He was mean to me. And she used to tell me all the time, I don't know why he's so mean. We weren't raised like that. But she told me the other day, she said, I wonder why he's not like that now. I said, because of some of the friends he had at school. And she didn't know all this stuff was going on either.
Melvin, I find that so fascinating that some of the kids knew about it because they were hearing about it from their parents. But other children just had no idea this was happening in their community.
Yeah, it was not something that, you know, it's odd. In some ways, it was openly discussed, but especially for the kids, it was not something that they were really exposed to purposefully. There's one point in the documentary where one of the women who, you know, she attended Washington or Webster, she said, we didn't discuss the marches at school. And when the black students would be coming towards the school, my teacher would go and she would pull the blinds down so we couldn't see them, and she wouldn't say anything about it. So you can kind of get a sense of the tension that existed in Hillsborough in the 1950s regarding this issue. I think that there were lots of people in the community, right, who, and this is that northern thing where, you know, you want to say like, oh, we're not, you know, racist or proponents of, you know, segregation. They would say, well, why can't these students just wait a few years until we finish building the schools? And I think that they told themselves that it was okay sometimes to disrespect these students because their parents took this action that was just them being impatient and things like that. So I think that the experience that they had really shows that there were lots of students who understood once they got into the schools and said, like, hey, you're a kid just like me. And there were lots of students who did not like them for a myriad of reasons. Some of it would have been the color of their skin. Others would have been the fact that they took this, you know, major political act that put Hillsborough on the map in front of the entire country. So it really highlights the dynamics, not just of sort of the school and of Hillsborough, but really what it was like in the country at that time. You know, there were lots of people who were, you know, lots of allegations of this is only happening because of outside agitators, things like that. So it was a very complex sort of experience once they got into the school.
Well, and I think it's also important to add, you know, this was a protest. And I think in contemporary times, we think of protests as being loud and chants and yelling. And when you see photos of this protest, they do carry signs But what the marchers have told us is actually they were very quiet, and that was a strategy. And the kids may have sung songs and stuff, but it was a walk, and they walked quietly, and they didn't have any loud. So it actually would have been very possible if you think about it. You know, kids are kind of oblivious a lot of times, and that if they were in a classroom, they wouldn't have heard this march going by because it was very quiet. And they were intentionally quiet for a variety of reasons. But it wasn't the type of protest that we think about today.
No, it was a very respectful action. They did not disrupt those classrooms at all.
And this was a protest that lasted 2 years. It was a case that was argued by Thurgood Marshall in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, the Warren Court. And yet, in my conversation with Teresa, we talked about how the story of the Lincoln School marchers isn't known. It's not taught as part of our history here in Ohio. And there are lots of people in Hillsboro that just don't know about it.
Support for WBOSU comes from...
Oh, I think we're waiting for...
...at the church last Saturday that showed the film. And there was a white gentleman that stood up. He said he was born here and raised here. I think he said in 1949. He had never heard of this story until he seen it at one of the churches. And he said, I think people need to see it more. And that's why we were so thankful that the Historical Society got us involved in telling the story, because it had been hid so long. And people didn't know, even kids that went to school with us, some of them didn't know. And they would come and apologize after they seen the film. And one of the ladies asked us, was we angry with the kids because, how we went in school? And we told her, they didn't know, we could tell.
Melvin, that's incredible to me that this case that went to the court, that was argued by this famous attorney, that was 2 years in length, was almost lost to history.
Yeah, one of the first questions that we asked the women was, you know, at the time, you know, and in the years like immediately following, did you think that you were, you know, a part of the civil rights movement doing this thing? And they said no. You know, we didn't realize it at the time. And I think that's one thing that's really important for people to realize today, is that you don't know sometimes when you're doing this big, really important thing that's going to echo in history. So it took sort of placing the story in the broader context to really bring out how important it was. When I first learned about this story, I remember looking at the dates and I'm saying, wait, this started before the Montgomery bus boycott and ended afterwards. This is actually, you know, this is a contemporary story. This is very important. But I think that there's a lot of reasons why this story was almost lost to time. You know, historians within the last 20 to 30 years have just started to recover some of these stories of the actions that women took as a part of this movement. And for a long time, it was a very male-dominated movement, and the story sort of revolved around men like Martin Luther King. So stories like what took place in Hillsboro were often overlooked. I think that also helps to explain why it has not been elevated as much as it should have been before this point. And another thing is that, there's a quote from a story on, I believe it was called, the court case was Lum v. Rice, which was a desegregation case in the 1930s where a Chinese family in Mississippi was trying to have their students placed back into the white schools. Ultimately, they lost that case. And someone asked, why don't we know about Lum v. Rice? And the family member said, the reason you don't know about it is because we lost. And I think that in the Hillsborough case, it goes up to the Supreme Court, but I believe that the court declines to hear it once it gets to the top, which means the lower court's ruling goes into effect. The kids are able to go to the schools. And I think that also helps to explain why some people have overlooked this story for so long. But once you place it in its context, you realize this was something big. And even if some of those children didn't realize it at the time, as the years went on, They now understand, no, we were a part of sort of that classic 1950s civil rights movement.
Yeah. I think there's two other important things to think about. I want to come back to how we, and collective we, I kind of mean institutions and society, decide what gets preserved. I'll come back to that. But I also want to talk about the post-case experiences of the children and the families. So I think a lot of, you know, they didn't really have a lot of time to celebrate or meditate on this victory, because they then had to go into the experiences of attending an integrated school, which they hadn't done before, and it was not a good experience. They were harassed by students. They were really badly harassed by teachers, physically abused, emotionally abused. They talk about this in the film, but right after they started, they said, oh, okay, we're going to have every new student who's come into Washington and Webster take a test, a placement test. And all but one of the Black students failed the placement test. And so they put them in a separate class for quote unquote slow learners. Well, what Teresa actually told me one time was that they actually got the answers to the test correct, but they had learned different methods of doing the math problems from their Quaker teachers. And so they marked those answers incorrect. And so some students, like Carolyn Goings, who's one of the children marchers, she got put back 2 years. And so they segregated them in different ways. One of the marchers said that the band teacher made them practice alone in the closet and really kind of segregated the band. And so they were, you know, there wasn't
other problems.
There wasn't a whole lot of time for them to think about the history that they made, because they had to figure out how they were going to, you know, move forward in their community and continue to be resilient. There's also this issue of how history gets preserved and what history gets preserved. So this story was reported in a paper like the Cincinnati Inquirer somewhat, but most of the reporting was done in Black publications like the Collin Post, Jet Magazine. You know, while there were some quote-unquote, you know, papers of record that reported on it, a lot of the really detailed reporting was done in Black papers. What Melvin, and Melvin's a historian, and we have some other historians on our team, and when they started to dig into this, there wasn't a lot of information about this story that was digitized. They had to, I mean, so it was really difficult to find, like, a primary source information about this. They had to go into archives in Hillsboro, and sometimes even kind of like sneak in a little bit, and work to digitize things, and you know, things are moldy and things, and so a lot of times we kind of take for granted that what's in the papers of record is the history, but a lot of times those papers were mostly reporting on white stories and weren't always reporting on stories like this, or had a biased point of view about those stories. And so that's where, you know, institutions like a local historical society, like the Highland County Historical Society, who really was the first organization to kind of bring this to our attention, and organizations like Ohio Humanities, it's really important that we invest time and money in amplifying these, because otherwise they will get lost to history as, you know, materials degrade, as people pass away, as, you know, there's so many stories like this.
And I'll also say, especially in a place like Hillsboro, it's not Cincinnati, it's not Columbus, it's in between. And sometimes people maybe overlook those in between places.
So Ohio Humanities has done a lot of work to bring this story back to life. You have the documentary, The Lincoln School Story, which I will say you can watch on WOSU's website through PBS. You also have partnered with a local author named Carlotta Penn, which is actually how I first heard about this story. She has a children's book called Step by Step, and it's excellent. 10 out of 10 recommend. I read it to my daughters. So I think it's fascinating to me now that we know this story. It's out there. It's preserved. These women are in their 80s. And so you guys got it in the nick of time.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, this year is the 70th anniversary of the Brown v. Board education decision, and we've done some, commemorations around it. And it was just like, we can't wait till 75, which is the typical year that, you know, you might celebrate something because
they may not be here.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the fact of the matter. And it was important to us. I mean, a documentary film is often a traditional way that you would tell a historical story. But we wanted to tell it in a lot of different ways, including a children's book.
That was Rebecca Asmo, Executive Director at Ohio Humanities. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you to Melvin Barnes, Jr., Ohio Humanities Program Officer.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on WOSU 89.7 NPR News.